Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon or good evening, and welcome to the Ron and Don Show. My name is Don Allen, co-host, and Mr. Ronald A. Edwards is actually downtown Minneapolis checking out the Minnesota Lynx and should be calling us shortly. I see we have some people on hold in the queue. Just stand by. Currently, we're broadcasting live from the Twin Cities in Minneapolis, where it's 75 degrees and no wind, and it's kind of muggy out there. So dress lightly. To all the people that are going to be hanging out doing something this evening. I'd like to say that I'm very interested in this Minneapolis mayoral race. We have 35 candidates running for mayor in Minneapolis, that the election is coming this November. And it's ranked choice voting. And for those of you that don't understand ranked choice voting, that's kind of tongue-tied, ranked choice voting. Say that 20 times real fast. For those of you that don't understand this, you go to the ballot or you go to the voting poll and you get a ballot and they ask you to pick three people. Okay? You pick three people that you like, you know, names that you might have heard, you know, associated with the word mayor. You know, that's what we do in the Black community. If someone, you know, we don't investigate sometimes. Some of us do, some of us don't. But sometimes we might hear some names like Johnson. You know, Johnson, so-and-so said Johnson. And so you get to the voting booth and, oh, you find, okay, I'm going to circle that one. And you might see Antonio. Oh, yeah, I heard that before. I'm going to circle that one. And then you might hear Taylor, and you're going to circle that one or scratch that in or whatever they're doing this year. And so you've made your three choices. Now, when all that gets calculated, say Taylor and Johnson have the majority of the city's votes. Well, your vote for the last guy is no good. It just gets thrown out. It's worthless. And so I guess what I'm trying to say with this ranked choice voting, anybody, absolutely anybody, can become a winner in this mayor's race. And I would like to introduce to you, I'm really happy tonight to have Minneapolis mayoral candidate James L. Stroud, who's running under the People's Choice, and I'm going to ask him. James, welcome.
And good evening.
Good evening to you. And I'm just going to ask you to explain a little bit to our listeners, international and domestic, that's your audience, about who James L. Stroud is and what is the People's Choice. And if you just go ahead and take a couple minutes.
I'll be glad to, Don. Thanks for having me. Hope all is well with you, and congratulations on continued success with your show. Let's see. My full name is because I'm named after my dad, who's still alive, by the way, 87 years old. Shout out to Pops in D.C. James L. Stroud Jr. Some people know me as Jimmy, and I am running for the mayor of Minneapolis.
Wait, you're running for? Or, okay, you're running for or running from?
Running.
Okay.
Well, I've run from no one.
Yeah, got you. I'm clarifying it for our listeners.
Oh, yes. Words are precious, Don. Thank you for clarifying that. Running, you know, the official application asks for your party affiliation or partisan position or your principle. And my principle, before this race started, I always been known as the People's Choice and amongst family and friends. And for political reasons, I see the definition of People's Choice as the guy I want to vote for is the guy who, even after everything said and done, doesn't come to the table saying he's representing one party, because he has to buy into all of that and only that. for the most part, but someone who is people-driven and not party-driven, and that's why I'm considering myself the people's choice. It's not just a self-appointed title to boost my ego or to amuse people, but it's actually a goal and a mission, and let people know that I've always operated this way, putting people first, and I would do the same as mayor for those folks who didn't vote for me or didn't vote at all. I would still represent them the same way I would those folks who like me, love me, and vote for me.
Okay, with that said, what is your opinion about the Viking Stadium? And I'm going to get into a little bit more of that later on with the phone lines open. By the way, the phone lines are open. The number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. If you have any questions for Mr. Stroud, we welcome you to call in. But getting back to what I was talking about, James, what do you think about this Viking Stadium kind of collapse at this point?
Did you say collapsed at this point?
Yeah. The collapse, yes.
And could you, not only because it's such a, you know, wide open and broad, it's just so many things happening. So I just want you to kind of narrow down the main piece of what you really want to hear about, and I'll chime in.
Today there was a statement from Michelle Hagelin on the special board meeting about legal issues, including due diligence. And, you know, they went after Ziggy Wolf to try to get his financial data because of the lawsuit in New Jersey saying that, you know, does he have enough money to build the stadium? And they obviously don't know that the NFL is the largest nonprofit in the world and worth billions of dollars. And they have Mr. Wolf's back. They don't have the Minnesota Sports Facility Authority's back at all. And so the kind of money they're talking about is like couch money, you know, the kind of money you find when you empty your, you sit on the couch and quarters fall out of your pocket. Well, these $447 million that, you know, these folks at the stadium are talking about is couch money for Ziggy Wolf and the NFL. And so what's happening now
it's assumed that, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And so what's happening now with the stadium is that there's several, like you said, well, there are a lot of things going on. One of the first things that are going on is that there's a lawsuit been filed on using the area in front of the stadium and around the stadium by the company that owns it. That's the first thing that's going on. The second thing that's going on is the special interest group, the African Americans, Native Americans, Latino, Hispanic, and all those groups that go down there and say, you know, we want work. They've basically told them they're assed out because if the stadium doesn't get built, you know, there's going to be no jobs. And the third thing that's going on,
sound like a very friendly response.
No, it's not. And that's normally what they do. And then the third thing that's going on, you have people like Senator Bobby Joe Champion, who's shucking and jiving, dodging and ducking and weaving, and is not giving full disclosure to the people of the city of Minneapolis about this snafu that, you know, him and Jeff Hayden kind of got together and, you know, talked about this and did some things, and right now it's not working out. It's not working out at all. So I guess my question is, you know, there's a possibility that the Minnesota will not have a team come January 1st. And my question to you, you know, as mayor of the city, would you have supported this? Would you have let the people vote on this particular stadium?
I would have liked to see the people vote absolutely on that, and then other things that with this type of situation with a proposed new facility and talking about resources coming from taxpayers, and then all these other things that come up when they're doing the due diligence. Let's just back up to that for a minute. It's really important that they do that. And what people don't understand is it's interesting how people haven't paid attention to the fact that this is a necessary process because of, what they call organized crime and that sort of thing, meaning that the reason we know all of the owners of these teams is because they want that kind of full disclosure. And they want to know also if they can meet the requirements for everything that is being asked for moving forward, like any other small operation or a small situation where you're getting a loan and someone says, do you qualify for this, right? So when it comes to the due diligence piece, you know, it is what it is, and they'll flyspeck everything until they find out if they have the ability. And then there's some other questions that came up that I don't know if I really need to even comment on those. But as far as the people, I think that the people should have, whether you're using the people's tax dollars or even talking about using $2 of the taxpayers' money, you're giving them a right to have a voice. And okay. so then those people who may be annoying to the owners or other people who just want to see their favorite team get a new stadium and be able to host the Super Bowl. And it's about dollars and cents. That's really what it's about. They want to expand to continue to generate revenue, and also for the league's profit share.
Okay, well, let's argue your point general to particular. It's hard to make an argument that any business is more successful in America right now than the National Football League. You know, the TV rights fees from CBS, Fox, NBC, ESPN, bringing the league about $7 billion or $7 to $8 billion annually. Needless to say, no other entity comes close in popularity. So I guess my point is that the NFL has got the back of Viking owners Ziggy Wolf, and the Vikings at this point are the only ones who put in some money. They put in $50 million. And the MSFA is looking for this other $427 million, which, you know, I'm absolutely sure the NFL has Mr. Ziggy Wolf's back, and he can get that money. He has that money because this deal would have never got this far in the first place. And so there's some missing link here with the MSFA and the people that are running it down there, and also a missing link with the elected officials in our community and self-appointed representatives that have been going down to these meetings and flossing and talking about jobs for this and jobs for that. And I don't know if you recall this, candidate Stroud, but about, when was this? A couple of weeks ago, the week of August 23rd, I got a call from several of my Somali friends who told me there was a black activist going into the Somali community telling them they're going to be working on the stadium in August. And, you know, you and I know that's far from the truth. And, I mean, you know who this person is, but I don't even want to waste the space and tell you his name. But, I mean, he can't read, so he probably didn't know. April probably looked like August. So, but anyway.
Oh.
But anyway, when you look at things like that, and you know, and you're running for mayor.
That still didn't tell me who it was, but go ahead.
No, I'm not going to tell you who it was. I'm not going to mention his name or its name. But when you look at incidents like that, where you know we have a weak mayor, strong city council system here, and you know we have things going on in contract compliance, in the Department of Civil Rights, the police department, the park, the Minneapolis Department of Health, the Communications Department of Minneapolis, City of Minneapolis, and who is wasting enormous amounts of money contracting outside with subcontractors for stuff that can be done in-house with staff, especially with the component of MTN, which, you know, every year Ryback swipes budget from them and they seem, you know, just barely, you know, scratching through. So, I mean, I guess my question is, the mayor has a lot of responsibilities, and say if you win, say you wake up that day in November and you have actually won the mayor of Minneapolis, what will your first 100 days look like?
My first 100 days first will start like my everyday. I always look every day how I can do more with less or do the same keeping things at par, still keeping the output, financial output, under par. So, meaning getting a hold of that current budget that they have on the table for this year and go through it line by line to see where we start. Now, one might think, oh, is he talking like a Republican? Is he talking about cutting? Well, no, I'm talking about still doing the same thing, getting the things that are necessary, and increasing some other things, but shifting stuff around. And then with my feeling is with a lot of these folks who are slinging money around trying to buy their way in and sell themselves to the highest bidders, you know, a bunch of lobbyists and a bunch of private business owners, we can use that to our advantage by having them, some of them, bankroll some of the budget items in the city's budget. From a private standpoint, if they really want to do something, we can give them a plaque.
Yeah, exactly.
And give them a nice ceremonial moment at the inaugural and some other times during the city, and you can give them a medal. And as sarcastic as that may sound, I do think that there is always more than one way to skin a cat, as cliche as that may sound. I just don't think people are always looking for stepping outside of the box. A lot of times they're looking for a template, and they're looking for what everybody else has done, every other city has done, and what the city or whatever someone or some entity has been doing. We've always done it this way, and that has been the problem for a lot of municipalities where things are antiquated and they get behind the times. Now, I know it sounds like I'm really broad stroking, and part of it is, but that's because many times when we're talking about stuff, this isn't rocket science, it's common sense. So a lot of times, without going into the weeds and seeing all of the details on some things, some of these things you start with a combination of approaches. One, you always start with common sense.
Yes.
And then the rest, you play the hand that you're dealt at the time, and you examine and see where you are so you know which way you're going to go.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the hypocrisy of the Ryback administration, but before I do that, I want to let people know you're listening to the Ron and Don Show. I'm one of your co-hosts, Don Allen. Ron Edwards is actually downtown, and he will be calling us later, hopefully, from the Minnesota Lynx game to tell us, you know, this is like one of the last few games before the playoff. The current time is 8:47. Again, you're listening to Ron and Don Show. Our calling number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. And we're on live with mayoral candidate, Minneapolis mayoral candidate, Mr. James L. Stroud, the People's Choice.
Junior,
yeah.
Because if my dad's listening, I was writing stories for different publications, the Spokesman Recorder, shout out to the Spokesman Recorder, my dad was reading the paper there in D.C. He reads the paper every day, the Washington Post. He's a retired 22-year sergeant major and 20 years as a first black branch chief at the Pentagon Defense Supply. Now he's retired, and he still reads the paper every day. And he was reading a spokesman when my brother and I were writing, my brother who's in D.C., and someone left out Junior. And my dad called my brother and said, am I dead now? Is he senior now? And so I make sure that I put Junior on it because that's what's on my birth certificate. So anyway.
Well, yeah, I want to discuss this with you real quick. You know, there's a headline in the Star Tribune, which we affectionately call the Johannesburg Times, that Ryback joins mayors in Obama's confab on youth violence. Now, it says that Ryback's in Washington, D.C., hugging up against Obama, talking about youth violence and trying to ban assault rifles and guns. Now, Mr. Stroud, I gather you live in Minneapolis.
Yes, I do.
And I also gather that you've heard of, you know, in the last, you know, 2 or 3 years, we got a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, a 9-year-old hung in the backyard, a couple of the 5-year-old and the 3-year-old shot in their homes while they played or slept. And there's been an enormous amount of violence in North and South Minneapolis. And Ryback's response was basically have mad dads ride on the bus, and they don't have any bulletproof vests, so that's kind of worthless. And other than that, we have not seen a big change during his tenure as mayor in economic development or opportunities for those areas. Now, mind you, I didn't say people. I said those areas. And so with that said, I think it's very hypocritical of Ryback to be in a confab with President Obama when he has done less than stellar work here in his city. So how would you, I guess my question is to you, how would you address this ongoing, you know, we're not hearing a lot about the shootings that are going on, the shots fired every night in North and South Minneapolis, people being stabbed, killed, and mugged. We're not getting a lot of that information because the Star Tribune is really not reporting a lot of that. But we have great community members that call in and they post on Black North Vent. They post with Northside Info Exchange and other folks. And we see an uptick in violent crime in North and South, in Minneapolis in general. So how will you address that if you win?
That being
the violence and the crime, and the shootings, the babies killing babies, black on black crime. I mean, the crime in general. What would be?
Let me just say that first of all, for me to respond to such a complicated situation. Sometimes they let me start here. First of all, because you put a whole bunch of stuff out there with the you started out with the youth violence and then some of the folks who are victims
to the youth violence. The youth violence, you know, we have babies being shot and killed in North Minneapolis on a regular basis. So if you went as mayor, I guess my question is going to be, how will you, one way, just let's just stick with the youth violence. How will you address that? I mean, what would be something? Because, you know, you could get in the office and be sworn in your first week, you have two or three dead kids in North Minneapolis. I mean, what? I mean, I know it's a loaded question, but seriously.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay because, you know, it'll be a bunch of loaded questions out there for everybody, including me. Yeah. And let me just say that, first of all, the crime is not new. This violence is not new. It's even worse than some other places in Minneapolis. But what we've got right now, even just on my block, I have held two guys we've got a series of folks trying to break in over in a nice part of North Minneapolis, and they where a lot of the folks are working during the day, and these folks are kicking in doors at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday. And so I, on Friday night, I do patrols by myself. I don't call anybody to come join me. And as you well know, that one of the other hats that I wear is put in the last 3 years, over 3,000 some volunteer hours as an investigator for the Legal Rights Center over in Minneapolis. And so at night, you know, a lot of times where there's dark spots, I'm last Friday night was out and was, first of all, I've caught six people so far for the police, and they'll verify that have been attempting to break into houses over on my block. Not to try to get any service awards or anything. I'm not a member of Mad Dads, although I, you know, applaud their commitment, their efforts. I'm not trying to be a vigilante or a superhero. I'm trying to make sure I seal off the fort where I live and then to look out for those neighbors that are right around me, like I always did when we grew up in the neighborhood I grew up in North Englewood, Maryland. So, and as far as your question, as far as what would I do, these things change daily. I mean, we come up with all kinds of stuff, and then at one time, remember a time when they were bulldozing and kicking in crack houses? When's the last time you heard that? These things change as the days and weeks go by, and by the time the mayor's inauguration comes up, we could have some other kind of problem. In fact, not only someone else being shot, hell, the new mayor could be a victim. I mean, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? So, mm-hmm. so it's always to me, before you can plan your work and work your plan, you really have to see where you are at that time and where it is currently. And if someone was currently, I guess I can kind of add on to your question to get myself in more hot water. If it was currently the mayor, I don't know if in fact what you say is true about there, or that's, you know, just maybe your perspective about a contradiction in the name of, well, maybe he's in D.C. and celebrating the idea that he's championed and conquered the youth crime problem in Minneapolis and now ready to share that with the White House and the rest of the nation. If that's what I'm understanding, I'm saying I don't know that that's something I would commit to if I really haven't solved that problem. I don't know if anybody really has the best answer. Some of them that are listed and ranked as the best answers are pretty on paper, and then when it gets real time, apparently, if we're at this stage in Minneapolis and the rest of the nation, then all those pretty on paper plans weren't the answer, and I don't mm-hmm. know who has it, and I don't mm-hmm. know that I could promise people that I have it. But I can assure you that the approach is important for whoever is going to try to tackle it, and that is making a serious assessment and looking at all of the variables, including the police community relations, as well as the nature of some of these crimes. A lot of times, some of them are like raising themselves, like being raised to make decisions that they're not ready to make. And so mm-hmm. a lot of them are getting involved with people that are a little older than them and people that are making unhealthy choices, and they don't know the difference. So right now, if you've got a combination of things that are psychological, from games that are violent, that desensitizes folks in terms of taking someone else's life and doing harm and finding that amusing and exhilarating and fascinating. And so it's almost like some of these games are training kids to be killers and to enjoy it. And I can go on, and then when you have other people rise up and go, someone who's getting ready to come out of film school, and if I say something about some of the violent films, and then you got someone protesting before I even start campaigning. They'll say, now he's attacking filmmakers, and blah, blah, blah. You're never going to make everybody happy, and you're not going to get everybody to see with a comprehensive problem that requires a comprehensive solution with many folks from psychologists to sociologists to law enforcement to lawmakers and legislators.
Okay, with that said, I am looking at the report again from the Johannesburg Times today about the fundraising by Minneapolis mayoral candidates with Mark Andrews' contributions, $272,000, with $69,000 on hand. To Betsy Hodges, raised $188,000 with $50,000 on hand. Down to Dan Cohen, who has $109,000 on hand. That's Stephanie Woodruff, contributions $5,040. With $3,000 on hand, a little bit more than that. And Jackie Cherry Holmes with $39,000 on hand. Don Samuels raised $101,000 with $56,000 on hand. And on the city council race, and this is suspect, and I'm going to let people know now, Brett Buckner's name is not on this list as far as raising money of the candidates' contributions, personal loans, spent cash on hand. There is no Brett Buckner, which is problematic, and we will have to investigate that fully because he is a candidate for Ward 5, and he is he's not on here. And so
not
that
on
is,
there, meaning that he didn't raise any money, or are you saying he raised some money and it didn't get reported?
Well, look at here. I'm alleging that he raised money and didn't report it because you have John Hartwick, who's running for Minneapolis mayor, who contributions $0, spent $0, cash on hand $0. Then you have Charlie Casserly, who raised $25, spent $20, and had $5 on hand. So there's no reason for. And you have Blog Yang, Ian Alexander. You have these people in that fifth ward over there who have raised money. And Brett Buckner needs to come clean. You know, he really needs to come clean. And this is pretty interesting and breaking news as far as I'm concerned, because he is not on here. And so I have a problem with that. So what are you going to do in the near future here while we wrap up, because we got to move on? What are you going to do here in the near future to launch your campaign and to raise some funds?
Well, that's a good question there, Don, because just for those who might be curious, there are a lot of people who didn't know. In fact, on Urban League Family Day, I guess a lot of folks aren't paying attention and reading the fine line that my name was in the original 35. Actually, the day that I went down to, I intentionally waited till the day before the deadline, which was the 13th of August, then put in my financial disclosures on the 26th of August. The day that I went down there, I had beat Jackie Cherryholmes to the punch. She was coming through the door with her daughter and saw me carrying out my packet. I plan on launching my website this week. Now, folks are saying, well, yeah, Jimmy come lately. Oh, yes, I am. But with ranked choice voting, we can end up with, as you said in the intro, some surprising results. My thing is to get out there and show people what I have been doing since I've been here, since I came here Tuesday, October 18th, 1984, on a 1033 flight. And and so since I've been here, I, as you and many folks know, that's why I put James, Jimmy in parentheses, L. Stroud Jr., because there's some people who know me as Jimmy Stroud, who used to do was a playwright, actor, comedian. Then there's someone who knows me as James Stroud, who's worked for everyone from the Census Bureau to spokesman, recorder, as a writer, photographer, and then other folks who know that I was the chair of economic development and housing for the NAACP with specific duties to oversee the Sumner Field lawsuit at the request of Kwaezi and Fumi and that then president local Leola Seals. From community development to economic development to having a prison ministry up at Stillwater Prison from 97 to 98 to talk with them up in the prison, to education, teaching entrepreneurship at the Minnesota School of Business, and working in the public school system as a paraprofessional educational assistant in the 90s, and now currently working for the Department of Labor as a career transition specialist for the Hubert Humphrey Job Growth Center under a contractor company called CHP International that has over 15 different Job Corps locations around the country, about 120 campuses that we have. And my job is I've been getting the students in my pool, which is the culinary, painting, construction trades, union jobs, and some other livable wage jobs, and got some kids some jobs this morning out there in Golden Valley.
Mr. Stroud, I don't mean to cut you off, but with that said, you know, we'd like to wrap it up here because I'm getting – but I would like to give people opportunity to call and ask you questions here in the next 2 minutes. The number is 347-426-3904, 347-426-3904 if you have a question for candidate James L. Stroud running as the people's choice, Jimmy or James Stroud Jr. I came up with it. And so, again, the phone lines are open. If you have a question, you know, you call anytime during the show. But I'm gonna appreciate you coming on, Mr. Stroud.
Short notice, on a fire drill notice.
Well, hey, don't get into
but I do appreciate it more than you appreciate me coming on. I thank you for even considering me come on.
I mean, we've had other candidates for Minneapolis mayor on the show, and you know, as journalists, we're not endorsing anyone, but we think it's important that we let some of the people get on the radio, you know, and let people, you know, here in town hear where they're coming from, and then we're going to do some updates. Stand by. We have a call.
No.
You're live on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, yes. I think I have, like, two questions.
Go ahead,
can you identify yourself?
Okay, my name is Lisa. I am a North Side resident. I do work in a community a lot, so I forgot your name, but I understand you are running for the mayor's position, and there's like a ranked choice vote, and so when it comes to the community members, they're really not that much educated, so then their best choice may not be the right choice when it's time to go and vote at the polls. So do you think that, you know, a lot of people jumping in the race, that has have an effect on, you know, the North Minneapolis, well, not really, specifically talking about the North Minneapolis residents, but not having the right choice in office. Another thing I wanted to say was that being the mayor, that, you know, you have to focus on a diverse group of people. So not only the question is how do you deal with black issues, but other issues in the communities as well to get their vote, to make sure that you're at least at the top three. And so that's the question that I have.
Okay.
That's a good question. Well, first of all, I think you're right about the whole thing about you could end up with the wrong choice with ranked choice voting or not ranked choice voting. We've seen that in history where for some folks it's been the wrong choice, and for others it's been the right choice in the sense that they got what they wanted out of the deal, and it wasn't for the greater glory of all the people. And so that I do agree with. And as it relates to, it's been my orientation coming from the Washington, D.C. area, which is it's just the opposite in terms of the racial composition. It's a majority of black folks in the Maryland, D.C., Virginia area where I'm from, in the Prince George's County area. However, you know, right in D.C., I had friends from all around the world that I went to school with, being that the, Embassy Row is right down there, a lot like equivalent to what's in New York, United Nations. And so that's those are issues that we've always seen come up and things in terms of, you know, how a person is orientated. And that's something that I'm sensitive to. And I've already just had some meetings with a couple of folks from the Somali community, the Hmong and Laotian community, and just some small conversations, nothing big, no big groups, but just to get an idea. And being a black person from North Minneapolis now, I listen to my friends and neighbors and some of their concerns about even just some basic stuff like some of the streets that are 20-mile-an-hour streets need some speed bumps and some other things. So some of those things that I've already made a checklist of those things. And let me just say one other thing to this young lady people listening.
We have another call, too. So
okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
One of the things I pledged, and I shared this, and this is the first public announcement of, is that, first of all, I'm not doing this because I'm not doing it for the money. So I am going to say that the first year's mayor's salary is $105,000. Half of that I will give to charity. And even if someone sees that as a ploy, God bless the 50 It's $52,500. So the first $2,500, I get to choose where it goes. The other $50,000, I'll set up a website so that people can, the nonprofits in the city of Minneapolis can divide it up 50 ways. It'll be $1,000 checks each. They can get on there and put their name in the hat and let the public vote who gets it. So I'll stay out of it, but it'll come out of my salary. And I'll sign a pledge and a promissory note when I do my press conference so that folks know that I'm serious. Hello?
Mr. Stroud, we appreciate you calling in today. We're on live here with Mr. James L. Stroud, running as for mayor of Minneapolis in this ranked choice voting year. We appreciate you calling. We'll call you in about 3 or 4 weeks for an update, but we appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Have a great night.
You too. Bye.
Okay. And now, the moment we've been waiting for. my co-host, my mentor, my colleague, Mr. Ronald A. Edwards, joins us from a hopping downtown Minneapolis. Mr. Edwards, welcome
to
the show.
Popping, Mr. Allen, thank you. I was being a little earlier, a little tad, but the Minnesota Lynx of the WNBA defeats the Los Angeles Sparks by 9 points.
All right.
And take a 2.5-game lead for the championship of the Western Conference. We think the Lynx will prevail. Heck of a game. Playoff atmosphere here in downtown Minneapolis at the Target Center. Crowd of about 8,000, a little over 8,000, Mr. Allen. But let me not disrupt in any way what it is that you've been talking about or dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
Go right ahead.
Okay, well, we're going to get into education. I've had someone on hold now for almost 38 minutes, but Mr. Edwards, I finally was directed by the Minneapolis Public School Systems today on where to find the information that I was requesting for individual schools in North Minneapolis or in the city of Minneapolis in the Minneapolis Public School District. And let me get this gentleman off hold here because he's been patiently holding. Mr. Nelson, are you there, sir?
I am. How y'all doing tonight?
Okay, we're doing great. We're doing great. We have Mr. Edwards live on the air from downtown Minneapolis and me sitting in the studio and you obviously in your home. But I know that this is something you had contacted me about earlier via messaging, and this is something that we have to get into. And Mr. Edwards, I was really shocked to see that statewide, 42,000 students, that you're showing an average of 32%. In reading in all grades on a 2013 proficiency. But now when you look at North High School, 42 students reading proficiency, 2013, you're looking at 11.9%. That's North High
School. Yeah, you know, that's just barely able to open the book and read the index. That's a crime against humanity. You know what I'm saying? That's a crime against humanity. But we've been talking about that for an extended period of time, Ms. Allen. I just don't know what to say. I listened to a broadcast on commercial radio from this city just before I went into the game here at the Target Center, and people are talking in terms of the deplorable scores, almost criminal.
Yes.
As we said on the program on Saturday, we are asking for the resignation of Superintendent Bernadette Johnson and the entire Minneapolis Board of Directors, or the Board of Education, as they call themselves. I guess I'm just not surprised, but I think it's horrendous as it pertains to the future of the African-American in the Minneapolis Public School District.
Yeah, and I agree 100%. And just looking at these math scores are just, they're below par, they're subpar. But, Mr. Edwards, again, this one fact keeps popping up. And, Mr. Nelson, I'm addressing you both. The white students in these same classrooms seem to be doing just fine. And
they're
I mean,
in the upper 80 percentile, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, you are
worst,
correct.
At worst, 75 to 77. And do you realize, I know you do, you have statistics there in the studio. I mean, in some cases, there's a 60% difference. I mean, I just don't understand that. A 60% difference in scores between white students and African Americans, and they're in the same classroom.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Mr. Edwards and Mr. Nelson, I'm looking here at the 2013 proficiency in math of all grades. And I'm actually specifically looking at North Senior High School because of all the mau-mauing and flossing that was going on, that we're going to reconstruct North High School and then we're going to do this and do that. And I'm looking at an 8.8% proficiency in math of all grades at North High School. That's out of 34 students. So, again, the district has lied to us about the number of students in the school and also has not given full disclosure about the curriculum in the school. So that's problematic all the way around. Go ahead, Mr. Ellis.
Let's get is Mr. Nelson still on with us, Mr. Ellis?
This is one of the reasons why we do have to rid ourselves of Superintendent Johnson. But one of the other things is we have to do away. We're doing away with the No Child Left Behind, which was a program that gave money to failing minority schools, okay? And giving these monies to minority schools, they didn't do any mean testing. You cannot throw money right down the drain. Good money after bad, as my grandmother used to say. When you aren't mean testing, you aren't getting your money's worth. The other thing we have to do is students have to start taking the onus of their own education. Now, we do have these teachers, these failing teachers, but nevertheless, we do have to have students taking their own onus of their own education. They have to speak up when there's something going on with them. If they're feeling that they're not being taught well by a teacher, or a teacher is singling them out because he or she may be dyslexic or have some type of reading disorder, that has to be singled out. But they have to also admit that they have a learning disability, which a lot of our kids suffer from. But because they have these younger than normal parents, and let's admit it, the parents nowadays of these children are getting much younger than they ever have been, and that's a reason why some of our students are failing, because these young parents are letting these kids play Call of Duty and John Madden instead of reading these books. So if we also put a little onus on the student to recognize what's wrong with he or she, as long with their parent to accept his or she disability, we can move on a little bit in getting these teachers to help educate our kids a little bit better.
Well, gentlemen,
here's my concern, and that is the issue of tenure. It is almost impossible to terminate a teacher, particularly a Caucasian teacher, teaching in an urban city school with a heavy and actually disproportionate number of students of color, particularly African Americans. They are well protected and insulated by the collective bargaining agreement and et cetera. And that becomes one of the great problems, because we keep talking about failing students, and sir, I fully concur, but we never talk about failing teachers. Okay? And
right.
Black America is being burdened with failing teachers who have no interest in the education of the African American or other students of color, but particularly the African American, because we are so disproportionate with respect to the platform of failure. But I would submit, gentlemen, that so long as there is no concern with regards to failing teachers, we will continue to have the problems that we are being confronted with, the catastrophe that has befallen Black America, if you will. And this is, gentlemen, this is calculated. No need for the three of us on this program to pretend that this is not well calculated. This is a
Absolutely.
Part of educational genocide, pure and simple. And people are being paid enormous salaries and consultant fees and et cetera to advance, really, the doctrine of educational genocide against the African American. And in this city, it is people, let me say it like this, gentlemen, people come here from around the country to see how they do it here in Minneapolis, and that is how they promote and advance educational genocide against the African American. It's as pure and simple as that, gentlemen.
And
no one ever talks about that.
Yeah, and
I think
you're
absolutely right, Mr. Edwards.
Yes.
And that was my next thing too, that we absolutely have to end 10 years. I mean you might yell at me, Mr. Edwards, but I was thinking maybe after 30, 35 years, a teacher should be forced to retire. The students are only getting younger, they're not getting any older. And I think kind of like an aging coach that isn't willing to change his playbook to adjust to the oncoming players. That's what these aging teachers are doing, especially white teachers that are educating black kids. They come in with the mantra of, you know what, we're going to do it my way, and if it doesn't work, it's your child that's the problem. And back to what I was saying too, Mr. Edwards, because we have some young parents, some of these parents aren't recognizing that these teachers are being detrimental to their child's education because he or she might be too young or just isn't paying attention. So you've got these old teachers. You know what? We don't pay attention to enough to when the kids complain about the teacher mistreating them. Now, some of them like to chalk it up as, you're being bad. But is that teacher singling out that black child because he or she knows that or deemed that child to be a failure? And once a teacher deems that particular child to be a problem child or a failure, he or she quits educating that particular child. And many like them, and that has to stop. And the only way we can do that is having someone that's going to be responsible enough to go in there and rid the system of these teachers that aren't educating our kids.
Yeah, well, there's one part of this that I disagree with, sir, and that is it's not only older teachers, it's a lot of these younger teachers. A lot of these younger teachers coming out of these educational programs at the University of Minnesota and Hamline and the Calcutta, et cetera, have no commitment or compassion whatsoever for the education of the African American. All they want to do is get in.
That's true.
Get that, and I think in the state of Minnesota, it's 3 years, gentlemen, and you have tenure.
Yep.
Okay, and you're
yep.
in business, and then what you do is maneuver to get to be promoted or transferred to one of the silk stocking district schools, if you will, and move on with your career for the next 25 or 30 years, gentlemen. Let me also say
right.
this: the Federal Department of Education. This afternoon raised a interesting question in a confidential email to the Minneapolis Public Schools and the Commissioner of Education, as I understand it from my sources. And that is, gentlemen, 77% of expulsions and suspensions in the Minneapolis Public Schools are African-American students. 77%.
Right.
And that's another method and approach that is now being used to jettison young African Americans, particularly males, right out of the classroom, right into the penal institutions and penal colonies
exactly.
of America. Okay? Go ahead, John.
You're absolutely right, Mr. Edwards.
And I just want to say that I have some more bad news here. I'm looking at all these scores here. We have a couple of calls coming in. We'll be right with you, callers. Just let me get this out. I'm looking at Lucy Laney and Sheridan Elementary School, reading proficiency, both schools, 15%. Like
yeah.
you said, that's not
Mr.
even open.
You're absolutely correct. Let's get those callers in because one of our policies is, you know, people take enough time to call us. We want to get them in. We don't want to talk and regurgitate.
Yes.
Let's get that caller in.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Well, this is me. This is Lisa. I'm calling in again.
Please do.
Well, I think it's. I'm so glad you talked about the educational piece. You know, I did work in Lucy Laney, and one thing I want to say is that I think we need to stop really playing politics with our kids. And when I say stop playing politics, we don't really include the parents in a lot of the decisions that they're making. One problem that we have that we probably could relate to the test scores is that they don't have proper transportation. So when you're dealing with poor parents, they can't get to school, and when you take the buses away, they have an effect on their education, on how they learn math and science. So this politic that they're playing with our kids, and when we go into our schools, because I worked in a school, we have not the proper staff to assist the teachers, and when you take away our arts and our gym courses from our schools, and you turn it from privatizing, from having corporations, and there's a lot of stuff that's taking place, and then the only person that suffers from that is the child, and they're supposed to concentrate. I mean, when you look at Chicago, you had teachers that walked out on their students. I think history, the teachers felt that, you know, it was important to educate them. So it's so much about how much we're getting paid to educate them, and then the thing where we don't even really hold teachers responsible when they don't, you know, meet the standards of our kids. I mean, why are we just blaming the parents? We need to include them, and we need to respect their decision and what's going on in their household. So, I mean, this educational piece, I think you really need to dedicate more than one show to it, because you have the parents, you have the corporations, you have the Teachers Federation, all these people that's fighting, but then you don't even have the child that's speaking on what their needs are. So, I mean, you need to really dedicate a lot to the education. And I really agree that the superintendent, being African-American, specifically over here in North Minneapolis or wherever you have students of color, you know, their standards must be high as well. We must hold the superintendent to a higher standard than we are today, because it's more than just about politics. I don't care if she's a Democrat. I don't care about any of that. It's about morals and what your standards are when it comes to educating our children, because they are the future. And our elders, we're in a baby boomer state, and they need to bounce on up out of here and make more right decisions or retire. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
And Mr. Edwards, another sign that this, you know, we talked on our show Saturday about the young man that was arrested in Roosevelt High School for rape.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking at Roosevelt High School, and I'm looking at math all grades, 2013 proficiency for black males. It's at 3%. That ain't even 3%. And then when I go up here, and I'm looking at I'm going to look. I'm not going to even choose a gender. I'm just going to do African Americans. Well, no, let's do females. And I'm going to look here, and it calculates it real quick here for me. The math proficiency, African American females, is at 9.1% for 55 students at Roosevelt Senior High, females, African American. And These grades, once you look in this matrix that they have here online at the Minnesota Department, if anybody wants to see that for yourself, go to the Minnesota Department of Education and click on data for parents and educators. And it has, you can look at every school in the state of Minnesota, all the Minneapolis public schools, every one of them. And one thing I'm having a problem with, Mr. Edwards, that I'm going to look for right now while we have everybody on the phone, is the Minneapolis Urban League High School, who has, since I've been following them, has never turned in grades to the state.
In fact, based on that lack of both cooperation and reporting, that school was supposedly to have been defunded of federal monies because of their continued violation of not filing reports in a timely manner. But then, why are we surprised? Well, let's get that caller, Mr. Allman, because if we got people calling us, we want to get them on.
Okay, that was a caller. We did talk to the caller. There was just someone waiting in the queue. So, I mean, they want to listen.
Okay.
They want to listen, yeah. So there was a caller, and there was one person waiting in the queue, so we did get all of our callers. You're listening to the Ron and Don Show with Ronald A. Edwards and Don Allen. And that call-in number is 347-426-3904. Again, the number is 347-426-3904, and we're talking about the catastrophic failure of the Minneapolis Public School Administration. Now, Mr. Edwards and Mr. Nelson, both of you guys had talked about the teachers' point of view. The teachers, you know, that I have to disagree with the teacher thing, and I think that teachers should be sought after like NBA first-round draft picks, and I also think that they should be paid like this. I think like that. I think the problem from the Minneapolis Public Schools is in that headquarters building. And I don't think these students or these classrooms are given the freedom to teach. I think they're just given the freedom to try to get these people to pass the test. And if you know, if you're in education, if that's all you're doing and there's no creativity, it gets boring for the teacher, it gets boring for the students, and then you have the failing grades, which is obvious to what has happened here with these 3, 15, 8%, 5%, you know, reading and math of these different schools. And to make it a really heinous, all the schools in the Minneapolis public school systems with black people's names are failing.
You know? Yeah, you pointed that out on the program last Saturday. Absolutely correct.
And I'm like, oh, my goodness. I'm glad we don't have Frederick Douglass Elementary School, because that would just, Frederick Douglass would roll over in his grave if he, you know, got
those
kind of
schools. I think, Mr. Allen, that there's going to have to be a inquiry. The previous caller, Lisa, I think, laid out a challenge, and that is, I think that some questions are going to have to be posed in writing to the Commissioner of Education, who herself grew up in public housing, attended the Minneapolis public schools. By the way, just so the folks understand, the two co-hosts of this program, Mr. Allen and myself, are both graduates of the Minneapolis public school system, though there is 20 years difference between us. We are both graduates of the Minneapolis public school system. This is not the system that I knew, okay?
No.
And was challenged to be able to survive. And by the way, let me also say this on the issue of survival. And when I talk about survival, I'm talking in terms of being able to matriculate and receive that diploma, not a certificate of attendance, if you will. See, a lot of folks are not paying any attention to the fact that far too many African-American students and others of color no longer receive diplomas. And what you merely do, you're allowed to put on the gown and cap, and when you walk across the stage, they hand you a parchment of paper, which is really a certificate of attendance, if you will. It is not a diploma. And many parents are shocked, because those that are aggressively trying to encourage their children to go to junior college, a full four-year college, and et cetera, are stunned when they see their grades or the lack of, if you will. And this is also a part of something that we've also touched on, and that is so many of our African-American students and others of color are being pushed into special education, which implies, based on how it is referred to, and there's facilitation on behalf of the doctrine, is that these are human beings that have severe problems, if you will, emotional and otherwise. That's really the reason for the 77% suspension in the Minneapolis public schools of African Americans. 77% of those that are suspended and expelled in the Minneapolis public schools are African Americans, and primarily, by the way, males.
Yes,
absolutely outrageous, gentlemen.
We have a full queue tonight, and I know some of you people got a burning desire to call in and talk about this. That number is 347-426-3904, because I can't even hold any more people in the queue and in the chat room. So I'll need you guys to call in and let's talk about this. Go ahead, Mr. Nelson.
Isn't it interesting that, or isn't it how always has been that way, that when they don't know how to deal with our children, it's easier to suspend them. It's easier to brand them as a problem child so that they can quit educating them. And then what 807 does is, once that child is deemed unteachable.
Just a slight correction. 1250 now. It's 1250.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. What they do unteachable.
That's their new multi-million-dollar hit.
Oh, across the street from Popeyes. I forget. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
And Shiloh International Ministries.
Mm-hmm. Right across the street from it. Amen. Have mercy. Once they deem you to be unteachable, it's easy for them to then deem you as a problem child. So then they start pushing these children into, well, why don't you go get your GED? It makes it easier, again, for that teacher to take the easy way out. Ms. Johnson is not putting the onus on the people we're paying to educate. Don, I agree with you that we should pay these teachers. We should pay them well. But, again, what we need to means test which of these teachers aren't educating our kids, and they should be paid as such.
That is an excellent point. It's like being on a production line, if you will. But I equate it to this. I equate it to the higher educational system here in the United States. See, you should not be able to acquire tenure until you have accomplished a specific number of successful teaching years and that you have maintained a specific percentage of graduations and achievements and proficiency, Mr. Allen, in the specific disciplines, be it reading, math, science, or et cetera. If you fall behind that, fall below that threshold, then the teachers should be required to go back for remedial, if you will, re-education. Okay. Now, in the case of the African American, the fallback position is to push you out of school and push you towards the criminal justice system. We're not going to be that harsh. We want to be fair-minded, right, sensitive, and compassionate. But clearly, this process of giving one tenure and making one an absolute, quote-unquote, employee, and then I say absolute in the context that no matter how poor your performance is as an educator, as a teacher, you have got a guaranteed job. You can get up every morning, if you will, and get in your car, basically drive in from the suburbs, and continue to miseducate the sons and daughters of the African. I mean, gentlemen, they've got to come up with something a little bit better. Now, I think all of us come out as it pertains to our respective points in life, if you will, the millenniums and et cetera, that we have seen others that have come before us had these same ideas. What we're saying here is nothing new and fresh within the context of discussion amongst African Americans, okay? Only problem is we don't have the political clout. We don't have the institution. I mean, really, gentlemen, we don't have a single mainstream research entity, like, you know, the Heritage Foundation or major colleges and et cetera, in the United States. You know, we have to depend on, quote-unquote, our adversaries to provide the data to help us prevail in our argument, and your enemy is never going to give you the necessary wherewithal to both defeat and expose what it is they're doing to you, particularly when it's all about genocide.
That's right.
I agree, 100%. Yeah, so, I mean,
I'll throw that number out again, and maybe we got some folks that may want to come in, and this is kind of my role. We've got about 21 minutes left. Is that correct, Mr. Allen?
You are correct.
All right. Hey, we'd like to hear from you. You know, this is our inaugural program here on Big Blog. That's my name for it, Don. And we're going to begin to set the tone, if you will, on Big Blog. And we're going to talk about issues that are uncomfortable to a lot of people. Unfortunately, it's uncomfortable to some of our leaders who we have entrusted the mission of survival of the African-American to, you know. And as Mr. Allen knows, we have some callers on our Saturday program from Maryland and et cetera, some gentlemen who are really on top of their game, and maybe we'll be hearing from them again. But those are some of my observations, gentlemen, as we move into the last 19 minutes of tonight's program.
Well, Mr. Edwards, I'm glad that you called in because I'm going to step away from education just for 2 seconds here, and I had asked Mr. Nelson to call in because we were discussing the grades online, actually offline and online. That's why I thought it would be a great show. But today, the Star Tribune, we affectionately call the Johannesburg Times, came out with the list of the candidates and how much money they have. One thing missing from the city council candidates is one Brett Buckner, and how much his contributions were, personal loans, spent, cash on hand, and report. We do not have a report online. We have it from Brog Yang, Ian Alexander, who's actually done real well with $20,000 and $16,000 spent, $3,000 in the bank. So he's on the number. Blog Yang is on there, $8,000, $21,000 spent. He gave himself a personal loan of $12,000, zero cash on hand. And I don't see Brett Buckner anywhere on there.
Here's the problem with Brett Buckner, and they're, you know, really trying to keep it quiet and, you know, on the down low, et cetera. Mr. Buckner and his treasurer, of record as of 2 weeks ago, had a falling out. And the treasurer, according to very reliable sources, return the checkbook and all pertinent records and files back to Mr. Buckner. Now, I think that was calculated because of some checks and et cetera that seemed to be appearing in some interesting bank accounts, okay? And so when you get a situation in the political campaign where your treasurer bails out on you, you really can't expect the kind of clarity, if you will, due diligence, if you will, and meeting the statutory requirements to report how much money that you've raised. Now, my understanding is that Mr. Buckner has been raising a nice piece of money. We would certainly call upon him. Well, we would certainly call upon the candidates in the Fifth Ward to call upon him to file that information before the general election in November. But I don't think it's going to happen, Mr. Allen, particularly in light of the controversy surrounding the departure of Mr. Buckner's treasurer, who, as I said before, returned all financial documents, but most importantly, gave him back the checkbook.
And, Mr. Edwards, I have to confirm that because I was sitting in a room where his accountant was, who said to me,
oh, my
quote,
God.
Yes, who said to me, quote, there were some things going on that I didn't feel comfortable with, and I gave him the checkbook back.
Mm.
She said that to me personally, in front of a witness. And I was sitting right there. So, yeah, you're absolutely correct. I talked to her personally, Mr. Edwards, and you are absolutely correct, 100%. Mm-hmm. About 2 weeks
now,
ago.
Now, one of the things, that's what I understand. Now, also, I'm understanding, I looked at the numbers for council member, the now mayoral challenger, Don Samuels, and he's at about 101,000, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you are correct.
But what I was interested in was the nice piece of money that he had been getting from Viking sources. In other words, the Minnesota Vikings, people affiliated with the Vikings and et cetera. And that goes back to his own admission in a copyrighted story in the Minneapolis Star Tribune about 5 months ago, that after his vote, for the stadium, he received an envelope with, I don't know, what was it, $5,000 in it?
I think it was a couple thousand, maybe about $5,000, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now, this comes an interesting time, gentlemen, because I want to shift for just a moment because Mr. Allen did post this information. We here in the Twin Cities and in the state of Minnesota are watching very, very closely problems pertaining to the continued presence in the state of Minnesota, the Minnesota Vikings. Now, tomorrow morning, Mr. Allen, tomorrow morning's edition of Minneapolis Star Tribune will indicate that the Sports Facility Authority, you remember them, Ted Mondale and that group, are expecting the Vikings to return to the negotiation table. I have a strong feeling that that's not going to happen anytime soon, which means that there are certain negotiations and certain items to be negotiated that cannot be consummated, if you will, if the Vikings do not return to the negotiation table. The most important is probably, you know, $300 million in tax-supported bonds that have to be sold, if you will, so that the state, can meet its obligation of $348 million, their portion of the pay for the stadium. And, of course, we no longer even talk about Minneapolis, the city of Minneapolis, who has an obligation of $150 million. Nobody even talks about the fact that neither one of those two entities, governmental entities, have met their statutory requirement and put their money into the big account. And there are some ugly rumors here in Minnesota, and that is that Mr. Wilf and his brother Mark are being courted by interest in Southern California to relocate the franchise there. And by the way, there is a drop-dead date, gentlemen, and that is the 15th of February, according to the NFL Constitution. The Vikings must at that time give notice of the intent to move the franchise. I keep that particular date, February 15th, 2014. The Vikings are required to give notice of intent Now, let me tell you one other piece on this particular Viking piece, because we have great versatility on this program. And that is that there is a specific series of obligations that have not been met, and some attorneys, NFL attorneys, and, of course, Mr. Wilf's attorney, are maintaining, gentlemen, that there's already been a breach of contract. Now, I'm hoping that that's not true. I mean, you know, certainly this is not colored people's business, as oftentimes is said in this city. It's not colored people's business. But the fact of the matter is that there may have already been, and I would ask people to certainly join and read my column in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, the largest and oldest African-American newspaper here in the state of Minnesota, where we go line by line in the legislative, quote-unquote, mandate of violations that have already taken place and obligations that have not been met, gentlemen. And so I just want to throw that out to our audiences locally and across the country and internationally. We do have a dangerous situation. I mean, even now we're talking about terrorism and violence and, you know, sending cruise missiles or anything in, like it's getting ready to happen in the Middle East. But we're talking in terms of the potential for the catastrophic failure of the largest public works project in the history of the United States, a $1 billion project called a football stadium, which may be and may wind up to be nothing more than a big hole in the ground.
And
phone
Mr.
lines
Edwards,
are open, by the way.
Yes, the phone lines are open. And, Mr. Edwards, I received a statement this afternoon from Michelle Kelm-Hagelin on the special Minnesota Sports Facility Authority board meeting about legal issues, including due diligence. And it seems like they're trying to position themselves because they're falling quick. And I want to relay that statement to you and our listeners. Because we have almost all the information, both financial and legal, that we need to finalize the due diligence review, said Board Chair Michelle Kelm-Hagelin. While the preliminary update given to the board today shows substantial progress, Dorsey and FTI will have to wait for all the requested information in order to complete their final report. However, Pivot, based on the information we received to date, we have indications the team will have the financial capacity to move forward with the stadium project. The report will detail our due. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Read the whole statement. It's only fair that the whole statement from the Sports Facility Authority be read over the air. Go right ahead.
Yes, and the last two sentences, the report will detail our due diligence process and provide findings to the authority. We expect this report to be finalized next week and make it public as soon as we receive it. End of statement.
Now, here's the situation that raises serious questions in many different circles within the NFL. First of all, the Sports Facility Authority, Dorsey and Whitney, U.S. Bank, and others knew that the Wilf family and the Minnesota Vikings had met all of the necessary requirements as it pertains to having a healthy financial portfolio, okay? What the real pressure play is here is to berate the Wilf family and attempt to begin discussions about them possibly selling the team to Minnesota interest, okay?
Right.
And we have a bunch of very selfish people in this state, because I have to tell you, gentlemen, not since the days of the late and original owner of the Minnesota Vikings, Max Winters, who the team was, you know, taken away from and manipulated out from under him, no previous owners of this franchise have paid anything or taken anything out of their own pocket. Okay, they go get loans from the NFL, if you will. They get loans from the banks. They sell the franchise, as did Red McCombs, as an example, after stabbing Roger Hedrick in the back, who was a local investor who thought he was going to be able to buy the Vikings back in the late 1990s. Red McCombs was brought in. McCombs didn't even have enough money. The NFL gave him a $100 million loan. He buys the team. He increases the value of the team. He then has some problems with his Clear Channel operation and empire. He decides to get rid of the team. None of Minnesota's local investors wanted to go into their pocket. and they came up with Ziggy Wealth, who, in fact, at the time in 2004 that this was happening, was actually in discussions and negotiation with the Ford family in Detroit to purchase some or at least half of the Detroit Lions. What happened was they told him that there was an excellent package here, and Ziggy Wolf came up with the money. And what he basically did was to purchase the Minnesota Vikings. Now, gentlemen, I'm telling you again that we have a very perilous situation here in Minnesota at this particular hour. And this, Alan, what you just read is one of the better powder puff statements that I have seen, because here's what the problem is. There is a drop-dead date this Friday, the 6th, in which agreements were supposed to be signed, consummated, and et cetera, so that they can get on with the selling of the bonds, because as both of us know, and anybody else that certainly has listened to the program, is that the electronic pull tabs and even the electronic bingo has been a disaster, okay? I mean, and they've got to get these bonds sold. Now, Michelle made the statement that the Vikings, quote-unquote, you know, should have a concern here. The Vikings don't have a concern about the bonds being sold. The Vikings already are entrenched with the support of the NFL to the tune of $477 million. The problem is that the state of Minnesota and the city of Minneapolis do not have their portion of what is required by the legislative act. And nobody wants to talk about it.
No,
oh, by the way, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, our major newspaper, is looking at possibly losing a $100 million development portfolio in the development of the so-called People's Plaza. See, these are things that are not being talked about in our beloved Shangri-La.
I just find it how astonishing it is how many people are so clueless about this deal and how they want all of the problems to be eradicated, but no one's admitting it, anything. It's kind of like they got the eyes covered over, they got the hands covered over the eyes and hand extended out to ask for the money, but not wondering what's going on. And so if this deal does fall through, which it may look like it may, you know, the people are on the line for it. We're on the hook for it because they got all the money from us. So the Wilfs walk away looking like roses like they do now, you know. They suffer none. Only the people do.
You know,
absolutely right.
Sir, that is a very accurate and profound observation, because there is a rumor going around about a meeting yesterday. Now, this is before the 7:30 meeting this morning, gentlemen, where the attorneys came in and met with, quote-unquote, the stockholders, or in this case, the stakeholders, and confirmed to them, and that's an interesting word, sir, that you just used, that they are on the hook. Not the Vikings, not Ziggy Wolf and his family.
That's right.
That the Sports Facility Authority, State of Minnesota, and others are on the hook if this thing collapses. Okay.
That's right.
And let me give you another example, just for the purpose of flow of information. The Sports Facility Authority has another drop dead date of the 15th of November when they must place their order for the steel that is needed on this big, great edifice, if you will, because that order has to be placed by the 15th of November in order for the steel to be on site in August of 2014. If that steel is not on site and they miss 25 to 30 to 40 days given the inclement weather we have here in Minnesota,
yes, sir.
The Vikings are guaranteed, or the Sports Facility Authority, gentlemen, is guaranteed to miss the drop-dead date of July 2016, when the stadium must be NFL and Viking certified to receive and facilitate NFL games. And you know who's about to go out of business, gentlemen, as it pertains to what's happening right now? Mortenson Construction.
Huh. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that who they contracted to help build?
Yeah, okay.
Mortenson Construction is, of course, the so-called general construction manager. But here's the problem. The actual facilitator who will actually preside over it, everybody thought it was going to be the Vikings. Watch very closely, listen very closely in the next 15 days, because the Vikings declined to take that responsibility, which means that all cost overruns must be absorbed by the state of Minnesota through the Sports Facility Authority. And my associates a year ago projected based on scientific projections going back to 1950, the pattern and practice within the industry, that we're talking about cost overruns of at least $275 million on this project. Gentlemen, that takes the project to $1.2 $7 billion. I don't know, gentlemen, where the money is going to come from.
Well, they call themselves the Jewish Jerry Jones. Maybe they'll, you know, rub a magic lamp and a genie will pop out and they'll come up with that kind of money. It's becoming a bit redundant. And seriously, some serious investigation should be done. But, of course, that'd be too much like right. And, again, we'll be left holding the bag, the people of Minnesota.
That's right, sir.
And I agree. This is Don. We have five more minutes left in the show, and I guess we should start to wrap it up. Mr. Edwards, I wanted to ask your opinion about what's going on in Syria or in the United States regarding Syria, because, you know, President Putin, the Russian president, has been kind of flossing in front of the United States and the United Nations because Russia holds a veto power to the UN Security Council, which is more or less used to block any resolutions that would lead the UN to intervene in some way in this case. And he's asking the U.S. to show evidence to the UN that the rebels use chemical weapons.
And let me say that President Putin is one of the more clever international leaders, say Ukraine, spy, KGB. Let me tell you how serious the situation is. While folks have not been paying any attention, that's why I always suggest to folks to get you a shortwave radio, spend you a couple hundred or $100 and get you a nice shortwave radio and listen to English language broadcasts coming from other countries. The Russians have moved additional surface and submerged warcraft into the Mediterranean. In fact, there are at least 4 to 5 Soviet cruiser destroyers and a missile cruiser, top of the line, just emerged about 12 hours ago. And what they're doing, they have positioned themselves behind the American flotilla, if you will, which is a couple hundred miles off of the Syrian coast there in the Mediterranean. Gentlemen, you cannot understand, and I know you do, but you cannot understand how perilous the proximity of these two navies are at this particular moment. I repeat again, the Soviets, the Russians, as they refer to, have deployed additional surface, and you know that they brought their submarines in, okay? A number of submarines were observed leaving Sevastopol, which is the Soviet Navy's prime port in the Black Sea. And those submarines are also in the Mediterranean. And so what you have right now, you have American, French, British, and maybe a couple of battalion subs floating around, and a flotilla of nuclear Russian subs as well as nuclear Russian surface ships. So, gentlemen, Mr. Allen and I will certainly be entertaining any calls on Saturday on our Saturday program because President Obama has painted himself into a corner.
Yes, he did.
Well, I hope you can't possibly show Putin any classified information. The president did put his foot in his mouth with that red line comment, but America does have some interest over there. You can't let this guy continue to gas his people. I think that We're extended. It's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. I think the one thing that we have to do is we cannot stand for this guy to do this again. All right, he's too close to Israel, and it will look weak if we don't do anything. Now it's not that we're beyond talking now. Now it's just a time for action. I know it's easy for me to say I'm not in the army or anything like that, but America does have to take a stand right now.
Okay, with that said.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
But I hope it's a measured response that can protect, quote-unquote, the future interests of the United States. But, again, we'll be talking about this on Saturday. Gentlemen, a pleasure to be with you. And, Mr. Allen, thank you for bringing in some backup for us. Again, though, Minnesota Lynx defeat Los Angeles Sparks. The Lynx now 2.5 games up with 4 games to play. Hey, go Lynx.
Go Lynx.
Thanks for listening.
Bass everywhere. People pissing on the stage. You know the chest don't care. I can't take the smell. Can't take the noise. Got no money to move out. I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room. Roaches in the back. Junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I try to get away.